The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. I'm Lynn Rosen, and I'm a friend of the Free Library. And I'm pleased to be here to introduce Geraldine Brooks tonight. Geraldine Brooks grew up and attended college in Sydney, Australia, and worked as a reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald for 3 years. In 1982, a scholarship brought her to the States to study journalism at Columbia University, after which she worked at the Wall Street Journal, where she covered crises in the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. She currently lives with her husband, author Tony Horwitz, and their two sons in, you'll never guess, Martha's Vineyard. Brooks's first novel, Year of Wonders, became an international bestseller. In 2006, she was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for March, which tells the story of Little Women from the point of view of the absent father. People of the Book was a New York Times bestseller translated into 20 languages. She's also the author of the nonfiction works Nine Parts of Desire and Foreign Correspondence. As a novelist, Brooks is a prodigious researcher, bringing us thick into the everyday details of the worlds she recreates for her readers. She speaks of finding stories where she can set her imagination to work on filling in the missing pieces. Her newest work, Caleb's Crossing, is the story of the first Native American to graduate from Harvard College in 1665, and is yet another work that vividly brings history to life. Before we invite her to join us, I would like to remind you to please turn off your cell phones and your pagers, and please welcome Geraldine Brooks.
Well, good day. I had a little time off this afternoon, and I turned on the television, which is not something I usually want to do, but I'm kind of fascinated by this many goodbyes to Oprah. And, you know, I feel that as a writer, we have to pay our respects where respects are due. She did so much for novels and what have you. And I think this was the penultimate farewell show today. Hard to say. It's more farewells than Nellie Melba, but, you know, she deserves them. And, you know, by the end of the show, of course, Oprah was weeping. And I found that I was feeling like weeping, too, because I realized this week that I'll never be an Oprah pick. But while I've been showing some of her favorite segments, they never pick my favorite segment, which I saw quite by accident. I think it was actually the first time I'd ever watched a bit of an Oprah show. I was actually at the doctor's waiting for my appointment, and I had a good book with me, which is my usual modus operandi. But it was just at the beginning of that stage where they'd invented the flat screen TV. And have you noticed that ever since they invented those damn things, everywhere there's a flat surface, they feel that you have to have one now? So even on the boat that goes over to Martha's Vineyard, while you're going through one of the most beautiful waterways on the planet, you're being hectored by people on Fox News, and it drives me crazy. But anyway, this day, I found that my novel could not command my full attention because the woman that Oprah was interviewing was telling the story of how she had been out sports fishing with her boyfriend the day that he had landed a magnificent swordfish, and she was videotaping on the boat, and you can see through her lens as the fish is breaching and fighting for its life, and I'm watching this, and I am so rooting for the fish here. But then I thought, maybe I'm rooting too hard because all of a sudden the fish changes direction and breaches and it's coming right at her. And the video camera goes like this and you hear a scream and the sword pierces her right through the chest. But she didn't die because the gooey material in her silicone breast implants deflected the sword and saved her life. And she had the x-ray showing the sword going right past the fake boob. And by this time, my chin is on my chest. And I'm going, you could not make that up. And that is a very serious admission for a novelist. But then I realized that those kind of stories are exactly what I look for. I look for the truth is stranger than fiction. Silicon breast swordfish story. If I came to you tonight and I had completely made up the basis of this novel, and I wanted to tell you as a novelist that in 1665, a young man raised in his own language and culture had mastered Latin and Greek and sat down and graduated from Harvard along with the sons of the Puritan colonial elite, you would have said, nonsense. But because that shard of truth is there on the historical record, it gives you a license to take that and create around it, to fill in the gaps in the record. Every novel is a journey, and the journey towards this novel started for me a very long time ago when I was a fifth grade student in a parochial school in suburban Sydney, and I had become an ardent Star Trek fan. And I loved Mr. Spock above all the characters. And I was so fanatical about this show, I waited for Tuesday night and I would take no engagements when Star Trek was on, and I sat there riveted by every aspect to the point where I could not only give the Vulcan salute, live long and prosper, but I could give it in the original Vulcan. So I wrote away to the Leonard Nimoy fan club in Los Angeles, and eventually the fan club newsletter arrived in suburban Sydney, and I opened it avidly, eager to learn more details of how Star Trek advanced people through the ranks and whether Tribbles made good pets and all kinds of tragic Trekkie trivia. And in the newsletter, I saw that there were a number of other kids who shared this obsession looking for pen pals. So I picked out a girl of my own age, and I wrote to her. And the answer that returned to me was postmarked Menemsha. And it was a town on Martha's Vineyard, and there were beautiful postcards of the sunsets from this town. And I wrote to that girl for 12 years, and I would get from time to time pictures of this fishing village and descriptions of what Martha's Vineyard was like, and it sounded absolutely marvelous. So in due course, when I got a scholarship to Columbia University, my idea was that I'd be there for a year, I would get the master's degree, I would maybe apply for an internship at an American newspaper, spend the summer, and then go home to Sydney. But there was one place I really wanted to see while I was in the U.S., and that was this Menemsha, to see if the colors of the sunsets really were as beautiful as those old postcards. And I mentioned this to a classmate of mine at the journalism school, and he said, oh, yeah, I know Menemsha. My best friend's family has a shack right nearby there, and I was planning to go and visit him this summer. Maybe you'd like to come with me. Well, to cut a long story short, Rita, I married him. And the two of us spent the next 14 years adventuring around the world as foreign correspondents. But whenever we got back to this country, we would always try and time it for the summer months, and we would go and rent a shack on Martha's Vineyard. We would always say, this is a lovely place to live. Wow. And then as we got older, we'd say, wouldn't it be great to raise kids here? And then in 2005, it all came together and we bought a house and we moved there. Well, it's very different after Labor Day. Who here has been to the Vineyard? Oh my God, look at you all. No wonder it gets so crowded in August. But come Labor Day, it's as if somebody carefully picks up the island by the two ends and flips it over and all the people fall off. And you see who's left, and they're your neighbors. And I was delighted to find what a quirky and diverse year-round community the island supports. But, of course, at the heart of it are the Wampanoag, who've always been there. And I was thrilled with the idea of suddenly having Native American neighbors, and I wanted to learn more about their culture and their history. And the tribe is very open to this, and they have a lot of wonderful programs and materials. And I had got from the tribe a map of the island showing sites of significance in Wampanoag history. And on the map, right near where we then lived, was marked birthplace of Caleb, first Native American to graduate from Harvard. And I thought, how cool. Maybe I'll run into him at the farmer's market. Because my eye couldn't see the 1665. I wanted to see 1965. That was what my brain was telling me it must say, because that was the time of the resurgence of Native American political activism and the civil rights movement, and that made sense. When I looked again and registered that it was 1665, that was when my curiosity was piqued and the story just took root in my imagination. And anytime anybody from the tribe stood next to me for 5 minutes, I would start banging on to them about who was Caleb and what do you know about him. And, you know, I managed to tease out as much as was known about him. And the tribe are very, very proud of this part of their history, that they had two tribal members in the class of 1665, Caleb, who graduated, and Joel Iacumus, who unfortunately met with a misadventure on the way to his commencement and never received his degree, but he had earned it. And actually, some of the younger Wampanoag say, oh, bloody Caleb, my parents were always banging on, do your homework, because Caleb did it, you know. So he was well-known and well-beloved in tribal memory, but not so much outside of the tribe. And that seemed unfortunate to me. And I had so many other questions too, which is, what were the English even doing on the island in 1641? So early to go there. And I mean, goodness knows it's absolutely inconvenient living there today. So why would you have put 7 miles of treacherous ocean currents between yourself and the other people like you at such a precarious time? And the answer interested me, because it turned out that the group of 20 or so families who first moved to the vineyard were trying to get out from under the thumb of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which had become a pretty brutal theocracy. And having arrived on these shores looking for religious freedom, were not really interested in advancing those same freedoms to other people, and actually had taken to torturing people who disagreed with them. So this small band of English wanted to do their own thing, and in that way, I guess they were pretty prototypical Americans. And the leader of the group bought the patents to the two islands of Vineyard and Nantucket from the two English lords who purported to own them. But then he sent his son out to the island to negotiate with the Songhkems, or the tribal leaders, to see if he could buy some land. And one of the Songhkems sold him a strip of land in what's now Edgartown. And 20 families built their fairly crude houses on that little strip of shoreline, with their face to the sea and their backs to the wilderness, where 3,000 Wampanoag made their home. So that's the context for this extraordinary meeting of minds, where a young man born and raised in his own language and culture is identified as a talented intellect, taught English and made into a literate person, then sent off the island to prep schools, winds up at Elijah Corlett's grammar school in Cambridge, cheek by jowl with the Harvard College. And I was curious about Harvard too. I mean, how was it that these people who had barely set foot here within a couple of years, were already planning a college, and not just any old school, but a college that would give a degree that would be recognized by Oxford and Cambridge as equal with their own. And so it seemed like a vast ambition, but it was a vast ambition that had no means behind it. So Harvard in the 1660s, by the time that Joel and Caleb arrived there, is an incredibly poor place. The building is 25 years old, the college building, and is already in terrible disrepair, leaky and creaky and cold because they can't afford enough wood to heat it. And the food is so notoriously bad that the cook has been hauled into court and asked to account for why she served the scholars mackerel with the guts still in them. And so it's into a meager providence, as the Puritans put it, that these two lads are thrust. And yet the education is outstanding in its reach. Again, I was really surprised. I had assumed that it would have been mainly a theological education, that the aim of the college was mainly to turn out ministers for the pulpits. But that wasn't so. It was a very broad-based classical education. The scholars studied only in Latin. All the lectures were delivered in Latin. But they studied the drama and poetry of ancient Greece and the political science and rhetoric of Rome. They read all the classical authors. They learned some Hebrew and some Aramaic, and natural science and astronomy, and at a very high and rigorous level. So to have completed that course of study with a class that included the son of the former governor and the son of the famous preacher John Eliot was no small thing, and Caleb and Joel really belonged to the tiny elite of educated men of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. So that's the facts, insofar as we know them. What about the fiction? I like to tell my stories with a first-person narrator. So I need somebody who's going to rise up out of the grave and speak to me. And I was thinking that it interested me that when Caleb and Joel had gone off to prep school, the minister's own son had gone with them. But the minister's son didn't make it to Harvard. He never matriculated, and he returned to the island. And that little shard of fact lodged in my mind, and I started to think of what ifs. Well, what if he was humiliated by the fact that these Indian youths could master this work and he couldn't? What if he was angry with his father, who had become so involved in the project of educating the Indians that he hadn't had enough time to devote to his own son's education? And who could be the observer of this? And I thought, what if it's a sister? And what if she wants to be educated too? But what if she can't? Because Puritans believed that the good wife should know how to read so that she could read her Bible. But beyond that, education was thought not only unnecessary, but possibly dangerous and detrimental to her because it would addle her wits. And it would make her unfit to be a wife because she'd be able to find fault with her husband's arguments. So I started to think about my earlier life as a foreign correspondent in some of the theocratic regimes of the Middle East. And I thought of a young girl who had been banned from going to school in Afghanistan under the Taliban. And she had stolen her education. She would climb every day up to a precarious perch on the roof of her house, because up there she was hidden from sight, but she could overhear the classes underway in the madrasa next door. And so she got herself educated, and when her brother would come home from that madrasa, she would do his homework for him. So that was my idea in looking for the narrator of this book. And I've got two young sons, and it's pretty hard sometimes to explain exactly what it is that I do all day. You've been helping them with their homework or, you know, packing the lunch, and then you say, well, Mum's got to go to work now. And I go up to my study, and an hour or so later, I hear footsteps on the stairs, and then there's silence, but I can feel eyes boring into the back of my head. And I turn around, and there is a boy with a disgusted look on his face. You said you were working. I am working. No, you're not. You're just sitting there. And I try and explain that I'm trying to hear voices. Are you a schizophrenic? No, I say, it's not like that. It's just that I write about people who've been dead for hundreds of years. And you're talking to ghosts. And I deny it, of course, but in a way it's exactly what I am doing, and I get some of my best ideas in the graveyard, walking the dog. And, you know, I love the dead, but I didn't tell my sons that because the older one would have changed his Facebook status and said, "Mum's a necrophiliac schizophrenic weirdo and she's up there talking to ghosts." So I did managed to get Bethiah to speak to me, but it wasn't entirely straightforward because I learned that there were no women's journals before 1700 in colonial America. Women didn't learn to write. Paper was scarce. They didn't have time. They were working too hard from before dawn till after dark, not only washing the clothes, but sewing the clothes, not only sewing the clothes, but making the cloth, spinning the fiber, shearing the sheep, and on and on and on, because if you're a pioneer settler, you either do it yourself or you do without. And a lot of that toil fell to the women. But I'm just going to read you a bit, rather than banging on interminably. Read you the bit where these two kids, and they are kids at the time they meet, Bethiah, the minister's daughter, and Caleb, first encounter each other. And these are two people who have nothing in common, not their ideas about God and who made the world, not their ideas about what's good and what's evil, not their ideas about how you walk on the earth, nothing except one thing, which is that they both love learning and they will both take any risk to acquire knowledge. So Bethiah is, she's been told by her father that she has to stop eavesdropping on her brother's lessons in case she's going to addle her brain with all this Latin. So she steals her brother's books and her father's books, and she takes them with her when she's sent out to do chores. And she also uses the opportunity to explore the island and to try and understand its natural history. So on one bright day, when the weather had warmed and steadied, I rode Speckle to the south shore. The prospect is remarkable there, where the wide white sands run uninterrupted for many leagues. I watched the heaving waves, smooth as glass, unspooling down the rim of my known world. I led the mare along the rack line, studying white shells shaped like angels' wings, and picked up scallop shells in diverse colors and sizes, warm reds and yellows, cool, stippled grays, and reflected on the diversity of God's creation, and what might be the use and meaning of his making so many varieties of a single thing. If he created scallops simply for our nourishment, why paint each shell with delicate and particular colors? And why indeed trouble to make so many different things to nourish us, when in the Bible we read that a simple manna fed the Hebrews day following day? It came to me then that God must desire us to use each of our senses to take delight in the varied tastes and sights and textures of his world. Yet this seemed to go against so many of our preachings, against the sumptuary and the carnal. Puzzling upon it, I had walked some good distance, head down, inattentive to all but my thoughts, when I glanced up and saw them, a band of them far off, painted strangely as I had been told they did for war, running headlong up the beach in my direction. I grasped Speckle's bridle and urged her in all haste into the dunes. I was cursing my folly to find myself alone, far from help, and my mare, hard-ridden, fairly spent. But in the lee of the dune, protected from the wind, the voices of the band carried toward me. They were laughing and calling out one to another. The sounds were of merriment, not warfare. Taking care that Speckle remained well concealed, I fell down upon my belly and crept along to a parting between the sandhills, from whence I could look back along the beach. I saw then what my first fear had obscured from me. They were unarmed, carrying neither bow nor war club. I raised a hand to shade my eyes against the glare and could make out a small sphere of tied-up skins, which they were kicking high into the air, and I knew then that they were about some kind of game. I had to look away then, for they were clad in Adam's livery. Fortunately, they were so intent on their game that they had not seen me. I needed to do the chore I had been sent out for, to gather sufficient clams for our chowder kettle. So when I had put some distance between myself and the beach, I tied Speckle to a great piece of driftwood, unfastened the rake from the saddle, hitched my skirt high, and waded into the brine. It soon proved a poor place, and I was about to give up and try another spot when I felt eyes upon me. I straightened and turned and saw him for the first time, the boy we now call Caleb. He was standing in a thicket of tall beech grass, his bow slung over one shoulder, and some kind of dead waterfowl in the bag at his back. Something, perhaps the expression on my face, perhaps my frantic tugging at my skirt, amused him, for he smiled. He was a youth my own age, some 2 or 3 years younger than the warriors at play upon the beach. Unlike them, he was clad for hunting, wearing a kind of deerskin breech clout tied with a belt fashioned of snakeskins. To this was laced a pair of hide leggings. Around his upper arms were twines of beadwork. All else about him was open and naked, save for 3 glossy feathers tied into a sort of a topknot in his thick, jetty hair. His smile was unguarded, and something in his expression made it impossible to fear him. Still, I thought it prudent to retrieve my mare and get away from this place, which seemed to be teeming with salvages of one sort or another. Who could say what outlandish person might next appear? I gathered up my soaking skirt and made for the shoreline. Unfortunately, in my haste, I caught my toe in a thicket of eelgrass and tripped into the water. He was beside me in a few long strides, a hard brown grip on my forearm as he pulled me up. In his own language, I asked him to let go. His hand dropped from my arm. I made my way, dripping, to shore. He stood where he was, fixed to the spot by his own astonishment. It was my turn then to struggle against a smile. I think it would not have surprised him more had my horse addressed him. And I would love to take your questions, comments, rotten tomatoes. In the former case, if you wait for the microphone, there is one on each side. Yes.
I'm about halfway through Caleb's Crossing and enjoying it at least as much as your other books, although I'd be hard-pressed to choose a favorite. I'm intrigued by the language. In some cases, a glossary would help. I know what song chem is. I think I figured out what TIGs are. But it was also the construction of the sentences, using some what for us are common words in different ways. And I'm wondering whether that's something that you discovered from a search or just made up on your own.
What happens is I read as much as I can from the time and place that I'm writing about. And luckily, you know, there is quite a bit to read, not by women, unfortunately, but there are a lot of letters from people on the islands. There are a great many discussions about the difficulties of Christianizing the Indians. And some of those, there's a wonderful journal by a young man, John Cotton, who was sent to Martha's Vineyard because he was being punished for his ungirt carnal behavior. And so he had to do a year of penance, proselytizing on the island, and he left a fantastic journal in which he sets out in detail the questions and the conversations he had. And it really puts you right back there, and you can see how perplexed he is because he's having so much trouble. These people will not accept the idea of sin, and they will not accept that they themselves have sinned, even though I assured them of it. They seemed much offended. Particularly a hard sell is original sin, because as they point out, the story of the Garden of Eden doesn't make a great deal of sense to them. Why would a father make a garden and then tell the kids they can't eat its best fruit? And even if this happened and this man Adam and his wife displeased God, why on earth would he be angry with me about it, who only heard about it this afternoon? So if you read enough of this in the language of the time, these kind of bright shards of expression lodge in your brain. And when you find your narrator needing to say something, little bits and pieces come back to you. And I pillage, you know, these expressions without remorse because I want it to sound as it would have sounded. And if I come to a word that I haven't encountered in reading documents from the time, for example, Bethia gets interested in midwifery and I wanted her to talk about a fetus. And fetus, I didn't think was a 17th century word. So I go to the wonderful resource that is the Oxford Historical Thesaurus of the English Language, which mines down through history all the way to Old English and tells you what word was used at what time. And I find there that in 1660 the word for fetus was shapling. And the minute you put the word shapling into her thinking, you are so in the 17th century. Lady there.
Thank you. Probably like many women my age, one of my first favorite books of all time was Little Women. And so when I read that you had written a prequel, so to speak, I was just delighted because I'd never had enough of that story. Reading Little Men and Joe's Boys and all the other books wasn't enough. So I was just delighted. And I have to say, it felt so right, the story that you created to explain the relationship between March and Marmee and the girls and everything just felt like, well, of course, that's the way it had to be. But I'm curious, not coming from an American background, and this is sort of a quintessentially American book, how did it appeal to you as something to explore, and how did you, what made you think that these were the stories that led to the writing of Little Women?
When I read that book, I was 10 years old. My mother gave it to me, said, read this, great girl characters. Take it with a grain of salt, because nobody on earth is such a goody-goody as that Marmee. But you know what? I wouldn't have been able to tell you it was an American book, because all the books I read at that period growing up in Australia were from somewhere else, and that somewhere else was England. And the March girls weren't so different to these other English girls who lived in places where it got extremely cold in winter and they had things that I'd never seen, like frost. So I circled back around to that book very indirectly, and it's a little bit of a long story, but I'll tell it to you anyway. So I married my classmate, Tony Horwitz, and we were foreign correspondents, and we lived outside of the United States for 14 years. And I had this vague idea that he was kind of sort of interested in the Civil War. When we went to stay in his childhood home, the attic was painted with all these depictions of Civil War battles that he'd done when he was 8 years old. Pickett's Charge and the Merrimack and the Monitor and lots of explosions and a lot of orange and red paint was involved in it. But I didn't think too much about this. And it wasn't until we came to live in a little town in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains in rural Virginia that I understood what I got myself into with this guy. He was completely obsessed. And there's a saying that the Civil War was fought in 10,000 places. and it soon became depressingly apparent to me that he intended to drag me to every single one of them, and some of them more than once. And I began to get very churlish, and I would refuse to get out of the car on the third trip to Antietam. And, you know, the nadir, or the apogee, whichever way you look at it, of this whole ridiculous thing happened when I wanted to go to a Bruce Springsteen concert. And he said, oh, no, not that weekend. That weekend, they're burying Stonewall Jackson's horse in Lexington. We have to go there. Stonewall Jackson's horse, about time, I said. Anyway, we went there, and VMI is a very odd place on an ordinary day. But on this day, there were women in hoop skirts, and there were honor guards for the little Sorrel's remains being carried out and laid to rest with the full CSA ceremony. And I'm just standing there thinking, this is nuts. And there's a guy behind me talking to his friend, and he's saying, I never understood how it was that Stonewall got popped by his own men. And I turn around and I said, well, you have to understand it was raining that night, and he was wearing an oilskin. And I thought, how do I know that? And I realized that I'd become a Civil War bore by osmosis. And actually, I did, you know the saying, find the handle you can pick it up by. I had found my handle, and my handle was the struggle of conscience of idealists who go to war. And that war in particular makes this a very stark thing. I mean, it happens in many wars, but people who went to war for the cause of abolition and because they loved humanity and then found themselves doing the most brutal and unspeakable atrocious things in the course of that war as it went on. And so that idea had taken hold of me. And suddenly I connected this with this beloved book of my Sydney childhood, and the penny dropped that it was actually a Civil War novel and that the father is away being a minister to the Union troops. And what more perfect vehicle to explore the idea of what happens to a good man in a bad war. Long story. Now I've knocked you all into a stupor.
Do you have favorite authors?
Oh, yeah. Probably too many to enumerate, but I'll have a go at a couple. I love Marilyn Robinson. I think her books, Gilead and Home, are almost perfect novels. Jane Austen, of course, is the master writer, in my opinion. Every line of her book is close to perfect. I love Andre McKean, who's a Russian immigré who writes in French, and we get his books in translation, but they're still beautifully written. The one who perhaps inspires me most closely in what I do is an English writer named Mary Renault, who wrote about the ancient world, and I think her Alexander trilogy, particularly the middle book, The Persian Boy, really is a model of what I try to do, which is to take a reader into a very different time, place, consciousness, way of viewing the world, but at the same time keeping an emotional familiarity with the character. And I think that she does that beautifully. And you can have a journey into ancient Greece, but the human heart remains recognizable. And the Australian writer Tim Winton would be another great favorite among contemporary writers, particularly dirt music. So, yeah.
Can I ask a second question? With all your international travels, have you ever gotten into espionage?
No, but journalism is not a totally different skill set. It's just that you can know everything I know for $1.25. But it involved the same kind of winning people's trust and getting them to tell you their stories and maybe to tell you more than they intended to, and sometimes getting into a bit of hot water and being in places that were not the most sensible places to be. And it was a very interesting life, and I'm really glad I had that time. And I'm really glad I'm not doing it anymore. Yes.
Have you ever thought of writing a novel about Caleb, but and, you know, from Australia, an Aborigine in Australia?
I'm actually thinking about a story that is set in Australia, and it's about the relationship between a very unusual woman from Tasmania and the Walpuri people, and it's something that I'm looking into now. It's a little bit too recent for me, Australian history. I feel very, very comfortable in the 17th century. I love that kind of period when the medieval mind and the modern mind are in struggle. And you can feel the modern mind emerging, but the medieval mind is still tugging on people's heels and trying to drag them back into superstition, even as science is starting to emerge and win people's hearts and minds. So, yeah, but it's definitely on the to-do list. Well, yes? Oh.
What was it like for you to win the Pulitzer?
It was great. It was, of course, you know, as one of my friends said, well, that doesn't suck. And I thought, oh, how very eloquent and poetically you have put that. But it was all the more wonderful for being completely, not even in the wildest ambit claim of my imagination. And when you're a journalist, you always pay attention to when the Pulitzers are being announced, because you might have friends who are in the running and you want to congratulate them, or you want to console them if they don't get the award that you think they deserved. And, you know, so you're watching the ticker at 3 o'clock on that day and the whole newsroom's kind of buzzing with it. But I was out of journalism and I was doing a fellowship at Radcliffe in Cambridge, so I wasn't even at my normal home. I was in a rented place and not very many people had that number. And it was my son's, he was 9 at the time, it was his first day of his spring break. So I was home with him and we were goofing around and I was helping him paint his little models. And the phone rang, and I went to answer the phone with a wet model in my hand. And it was an old friend from the Wall Street Journal, and he thought that I already knew, and he starts straight in with this, "You're so great, this is so wonderful, it's really fantastic." And I thought, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Ken's been out for a long lunch. And he said, "You don't know you've won the Pulitzer Prize?" And I said, "Don't be ridiculous. I haven't done any journalism this year." And he said, "You got it for your novel, you dimwit." And I said, "No, you mean The March. That was Dr. O's book." And I put down the phone, and it immediately rang again and again. And then I never did get to get rid of the wet model that I was holding. And at one point, the doorbell rings, and my son answers it, and it's somebody with a delivery of flowers. And he says, "Mom can't come now. She's on the phone. She's real busy. She just got the Pulitzer Surprise."
Are you working on a book right now, and what is it about?
No, I'm not yet, and which is unusual, because usually when a book comes out, you've had months to get stuck into the next project. So usually by now I would have something well underway. But I finished this, and I actually delivered it on time, which so shocked my publishers that they said, "Oh, we thought we were going to bring this out in the autumn of 2011, but you finished it, so why don't we bring it out in spring?" So there was only a kind of a 6-month lag time, and I had agreed to be the guest editor of Best American Short Stories. So instead of going to work on the next book, I read other people's wonderful work all through the winter, sitting in front of the fire and choosing short stories for that collection that's coming out this fall. So I haven't really had a chance to get stuck into the next thing yet.
Any movie contracts?
You know, I've optioned. Every book except this one has been optioned for the movies, and as you've noted, none of them have been made. I don't know how anyone survives in that business. It's so frustrating. Year of Wonders has almost gone into production so many times, and it always falls at the last fence for some reason. There was one time when we had Colin Firth being the minister, Natalie Portman being Anna, and Liv Tyler being Eleanor. I mean, you couldn't get a better cast. And of course, now they're all too old for those roles. So, you know, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it, but when I finished this book, I really didn't want to just option it and forget about it, because I'd spent such a lot of time thinking about what the responsibility was to this story and this history. So it happened that a friend of mine at the end of the year quit his job running the Australian Film School, and he's a screenwriter, among other things. And so he came over, and the two of us holed up together and adapted this into a screenplay. So we'll see.
How did you get interested in writing about the Haggadah and people in the book?
That was a story that I came across when I was still working as a journalist, and I was covering the siege of Sarajevo. And there was only one functioning hotel in Sarajevo during the siege, and that was the rather inaptly named, given the circumstances, Holiday Inn. And that was where all the journalists had to stay. So at the end of the day, you know, you would drag yourself down to the bar after seeing some really dreadful stuff and compare notes. And one night the talk turned to the whereabouts of this missing treasure of the Bosnian National Museum Library, which was the rare illuminated Hebrew manuscript. And nobody knew where it was, and lots of journalists had ideas that the Israelis had taken it for safekeeping, or the Muslim Bosnians had sold it on the black market to buy weapons, and all this kind of talk. And I thought, oh, very interesting. But I was most interested in the fact that this little book had been created in Spain during the time of convivencia, when Christians and Muslims and Jews lived together in a spirit of not exactly bonhomie, but intellectual exchange. And and all that, of course, was smashed apart by the expulsion of the Jews and Muslims from Spanish territory. And somehow the book had survived and got to Venice, where it was saved from the fires of the Pope's Inquisition by a Catholic priest. And it made its way to Sarajevo in time to be sought by the Nazis, who were looting the great treasures of Judaica for this vile idea of Hitler's, which was to be the museum of the lost race, that after all the Jews had been killed, there'd be a museum in Prague where you could look at what they used to be like. And at that point, it was saved by a Muslim librarian who, quickly thinking, stuffed it down his pants and went and told the general, no less, who'd come to demand it, that he'd already given it to another Nazi officer. And then, you know, only to have the same kind of story enacted again with the rise of ultranationalists who wanted to destroy not only the people of Sarajevo, but the idea that people of difference had managed to make a wonderful city like Sarajevo. And to do that, you not only kill the civilians, but you destroy the evidence of those civilians' existence, like their museums and their libraries. And again, this book, it came out towards the end of the war, had been saved by Muslim hands when the librarian had gone in and risked his neck under shelling to bring the book out of the museum that was being pummeled and taken it to a safe hiding place where it survived yet again. So the story that repeated itself of human beings creating wonderful multicultural societies, and then this virus of hatred of otherness rising up and trying to tear it apart, but always a few people being able to see through the ideology of hate and standing up and saying, no, what unites us is more than what divides us. And that little book had become such a powerful symbol of that.
So I've loved many of your books, but I really love the one where you were interviewing Muslim women. I just wonder how you got involved and got into those tight communities and what that was like for you.
Yeah, that was my first book. That was Nine Parts of Desire, which I wrote when I was still a working journalist. I took a leave of absence to write the book, but I'd been 6 years living among women in Islamic countries, and I'd come to the realization that the way I could function as a journalist in that region that would be of most value was to try and tell the stories through the women of the region, because I could do that. My male colleagues couldn't do it, and it turned out to be a great way to work because it was more socially acceptable in those societies to seek to meet the women rather than to just bowl up to strange men who weren't used to talking to women that they weren't related to in many countries. So I spent 6 years, and I'd had some extraordinary experiences, including being invited home by Ayatollah Khomeini's widow and eating veggie burgers in the royal palace in Jordan with Queen Noor, and sleeping in a Palestinian refugee camp with a man who had 2 wives and 13 children. And I just acquired all these kind of, all this knowledge of how women negotiated their lives in these different situations. And so I, sat down and wrote that book, but it wasn't difficult to get the access. The women I was knocking on an open door. The women really wanted to share their stories. And really, I found that my interest was very welcomed by them. One more question? Don't feel any pressure. I mean, it doesn't have to be a good question or anything. It can be a really stupid question. No, actually, a journalist should never say that. My editor told me there's no such thing as a stupid question, and I do believe that, because it's when you ask something that seems blindingly obvious is when you can elicit the most unexpected reply. But if... Yes.
But when you said you were talking about maybe writing a novel about the indigenous folks in Australia, it sort of occurred to me, sort of a secondary question, was whether that put more pressure on you to sort of write about your own story or your own place, to sort of debate whether it would be controversial.
Yes.
And maybe it's maybe a departure of years and years, of hundreds of years, or a departure of another continent is actually easier in some
it
ways.
It is much easier to rummage around in somebody else's closet than it is to tidy up your own. But having said that, I thought that Peter Carey, actually, my fellow Australian novelist, talks about when he's in the United States, he feels like he's on a moral holiday because he's not responsible. And I don't actually feel that. I feel very identified now with my life here. But I didn't think that, I did have a certain amount of moral holiday thing going on with the indigenous history in this country. And then I found out that my great-great back seven grandfather almost certainly knew Caleb, because his sister was married to the schoolmaster who prepared him for Cambridge, for Harvard. So what are the odds of that? And I only found it out while I was researching the book, because my dad, I knew obviously that my dad had grown up in the United States, but he was born in Santa Maria, California, and lived all his life on the West Coast. And as far as I know, he never set foot in Massachusetts. And then I was surprised to find out that, in fact, his ancestors had arrived here in 1630. And one of them, my direct antecedent, was a glazier in Cambridge named Ephraim Cutter, and he makes a small appearance in this book. fixing a broken window at the college. And his sister was married to Elijah Corlett. So I imagine that he went by to see his sister and took note of these young Indians and how were they going with their Latin. So I am part of the story after all. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.